good morning, everyone. Sorry to the public. We were having technical problems getting started, so we are a little bit behind by 9 minutes. We will get back on track, I assure you. I want to welcome everyone back this morning. I'm going to call Human Services, Finance, and Policy to order on April 8th, and we will take attendance, roll call attendance. Chair is present. Ms. Hansen?
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for the patience. Schultz, present. Vice Chair Bonner?
Present.
Good morning. Lead Albright?
Albright, present.
Representative Bolden?
Present.
Representative Burkle?
Burkle, present.
Representative Fisher?
Fisher, present.
Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Hansen?
Hansen, present.
Representative Keel? I know she's here. Representative Liebling?
Present.
Representative Moeller?
Present.
Representative Noor?
Present.
Good morning. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, present.
Representative Pearson?
Pearson, present.
Representative Pinto?
Present.
Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Robbins?
Present.
And Representative Sandel?
Present.
And Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, present.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, members. We have a quorum. I appreciate everyone's patience as we deal with these glitches. The next item on our agenda is to approve the minutes from April 7th. Representative Albright, would you like to move the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Albright moves the minutes from April 7th. Any corrections to the minutes? They may be the shortest minutes we've had so far. If not, all those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the minutes from April 7th, 2022 are approved. Okay, members, next I'm going to move House File 4579. This is the vehicle that we will adopt, hopefully adopt the DE amendment, A22-415. So that's in front of our committee, and I will move the A22-415 omnibus DE in front of the committee as well. And we have a number of testifiers today. We have a hard stop at noon. It's really important for us to get through the list of testifiers because I am very eager, and I'm sure all of you are, to hear from all the testifiers about the Human Services Omnibus Bill. And then we will take questions and comments from members. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the A5 amendment, I would make a motion to divide that amendment.
We are not, Representative Albright, could you hold on? We are on the DE, A22-415. And then
fine.
After we get to the testimony, we'll come back to your motion. Representative Albright.
Proceed.
Okay, thank you. Okay, members, let's go right to the public testimony. I need the testifiers. We have a very long list, but please keep your testimony brief and concise so everyone has an opportunity to speak and so we can hear their advice, opinion, comments on the Human Services Omnibus Bill. And we also have a number of amendments besides the A5 amendment from members as well. So the first testifier we have, I'm sorry, Representative Noor, you have some mark on your, did you need to speak?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I'm trying to remove it.
Thank you. So the first testifier we have is Heidi Ekman from SEIU. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Ekman. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Heidi Ekman, SEIU Union. Chair Schultz and members of the committee, my name is Heidi Ekman. I work as a trained medication aide for the estates at Roseville Nursing Home. I live in St. Paul. I am a worksite leader with my union, SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa. Our union represents 50,000 healthcare workers in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. We strongly support your Human Services budget bill. We have submitted a letter that outlines some of the most important provisions, including a tremendous rate increase for PCAs in Article 2, Section 18. Thank you for including House File 3405, the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board. It can be found in Article 5, Sections 1 through 9, plus Sections 25 and 26. It is the best way to overcome our workforce crisis. I first started working at Estates at Roseville in 2011. Before that, I worked at another nursing home for 4 years. Long-term dedicated employees like me are the backbone of the industry. We are at the breaking point. When COVID-19 started, half of my coworkers quit. Day after day, I struggled with just 3 coworkers to care for 28 people. I would routinely work for a full 8-hour shift without stopping once. No break for food, no break for a drink of water, not even a break to go to the bathroom. But I would still make time to sit and hold the hand of a resident who was dying alone and unable to see their family. I personally have been offered a job at an assisted living facility that pays more for work that is less stressful. I have been recruited for Amazon for a job that could pay double what I make. I know a coworker who dropped her second shift at the nursing home. She now makes just as much driving only 2 to 4 hours for Amazon. At my facility, certified nursing assistants start at just $1,506. After 7 years, your wage will increase to $1,598. That is less than a dollar for 7 years of dedication. These wages are not enough to attract the tens of thousands of coworkers we need to recruit or to keep them coming back. The only reason I stay is because I love my residents, but working short-staffed means I can't give them the care they deserve. Instead of pride, every day I come home feeling depressed at how I can't give them the care they need and deserve. I have given almost 15 years to this industry. The employers have had many years to build a workforce that could survive this crisis. In my experience, the best way to raise standards is to give workers a voice in setting them. We feel like no one listens because we have no power. It is hard to imagine a light at the end of the tunnel. To see the light, we need you to give us a voice. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Ms. Ekmans, for your testimony today. The next testifier I have on my list is Commissioner Conley from Hennepin County. And then after the commissioner on deck is Steve Horsfield. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner. Please state your name and proceed.
Good morning and thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Angela Conley and I am a Hennepin County Commissioner. On the board, I chair the Health and Human Services Committee. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify before the committee today. Your work is so vital to Minnesotans and real people depend on the good work that you're doing. At Hennepin County, our vision for our services continuum is to ensure that homelessness is rare, brief, and non-recurring, and that all residents have equitable access to increased housing stability. Before COVID-19 struck, the Twin Cities region was grappling with surging homelessness. The pandemic only exacerbated the problem, but also brought new resources to address it. And in partnership with state, local, nonprofits, and federal funding, Hennepin County has invested significantly on affordable housing for those with the lowest incomes and people experiencing homelessness, committing $91 million in American Rescue Plan funding. The investment is primarily with one-time money, and it faces a financial cliff when the ARP funds end. Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Gomez, for the direct appropriation in this bill to maintain these services at Avivo Village and fill the funding gap to build the Simpson Shelter. We also strongly support the ongoing funding for Emergency Services Grants Program and Emergency Shelter Grant Program and encourage you to commit this funding to the highest priority projects as directed by the local community. Investing in homelessness response alongside investments in housing finance structures allows the state to ensure safety for people experiencing homelessness while continuing with the ultimate goal of ending homelessness. Hennepin County also supports the housing support modification provision in this bill. So I want to thank you for the opportunity and the chance to testify before you today, Madam Chair and Commissioners.
Thank you, Commissioner. After Steve Horsfield, we have Maren Holden. So you're on deck, Ms. Holden. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Horsfield. Please state your name and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Steve Horsfield. I serve as Executive Director with Simpson Housing Services, and it's certainly an honor to follow Commissioner Conley, who is such a vital partner to us in our work. For more than 40 years, Simpson has been operating emergency shelter and supportive housing programs across the Twin Cities metro area. Housing instability, as we all know, and homelessness disproportionately impact communities of color. So by default, then, our program participants are overwhelmingly Black, Native, Latin American, and mixed race. On behalf of the community that surrounds our work, including thousands of participants in our programs each year, we strongly support the inclusion of funding in the Human Services Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill for a new and improved Simpson facility. This project has been in development for a number of years with the support of neighborhood and community groups, private sector financial support, city and county financial support, state agency support. Really, the only missing piece of our financial puzzle is support from the legislature at this point. And really, because the state does not accommodate shelter capital funding through the bonding process, this is our only avenue for this last component of our funding. With these last $4 million, we will have exceeded $30 million in our multi-year campaign to build a full-service facility that will serve to lift guests out of homelessness and poverty. We are thrilled to be at this point of being shovel ready with our project. On behalf of Simpson, I'd like to thank Representative Gomez for her leadership and Chair Schultz for her inclusion of this funding in the amendment to House File 4579, and I ask committee members for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Horsfield, for your testimony today. After Ms. Holden, on deck is Jillian Nelson. Ms. Holden, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair Schultz and members. My name is Varen Holden, and I'm an attorney at Legal Aid, which includes the Minnesota Disability Law Center. Our Legal Aid and DLC's clients are experiencing such challenging times, a workforce collapse that keeps people from getting the supports they need, disrupts living arrangements that folks have worked so hard to put together, and pushes folks into more increasingly segregated settings. Our clients have also been on the receiving end of a K-shaped recovery from the pandemic that's put even more pressure on our lowest income clients. So thank you so much for listening. This bill does so much to address the immediate problems our clients face, in addition to building towards a better future. We're really grateful for very needed rate increases. The PCA rate framework increase to the implementation factor in Article 2, Section 18 will allow PCAs to get paid more, which is just so needed right now. Last night, there's a PCA Connections Facebook group, and someone posted, "Seems like we are all looking for a PCA, but little to no people are responding," and everyone seemed to agree. Other essential PCA flexibilities, lifting the 40-hour cap PCA for PCA-paid parents and spouses, that's Article 2, Sections 12, 16, and 17, allowing PCAs to bill for time spent driving, Article 2, Sections 8 through 11. And then also we're really grateful for the changes to the elderly waiver rates so that people using the elderly waiver will be able to better stay in their own homes and communities, and that's in Article 5. This bill also does a lot to advance inclusion and accessibility in our disability programs, solutions to support people with disabilities to live in their own homes, which is especially important as the workforce shortage makes this more challenging, expanding shared services, equitable service termination appeal rights, that's all in Article 2. And then thank you for funding support coordination training for case managers, which is in Article 15, Section 2, Subdivision 20, Paragraph C. You also include improving access to employment supports by increasing the employment exploration rates in Article 2, Section 21. And we're really grateful for the inclusion of the Disability Services Accessibility Task Force and pilot projects in Article 2, Section 38. We hear so often from people who find the process of accessing disability services to be a challenge. So we're really grateful that these pilots and task force are included. This bill also includes smart alignments in our public benefits programs, aligning the MFIP and general assistance benefits with SNAP's six-month reporting and budgeting. This will make things much more predictable for parents in budgeting their monthly earnings and eliminating unnecessary paperwork. That's all in Article 9. Aligning the RSDI and SSI income disregards for MFIP. This change is really narrowly tailored to target low-income parents who are accessing federal RSDI benefits but are still struggling to make ends meet, and that's in Article 9, too. Also, this bill includes really smart, targeted increases in food and other benefits, an increase to the general assistance benefits in Article 9. This The general assistance benefit of $203 per month for single adults hasn't increased since 1986. Thank you so much for including both a modest increase and for an annual cost of living adjustment. And finally, increasing the gross income limit for SNAP to 200% of federal poverty guidelines. This will help address food insecurity statewide, particularly for older adults. This is a really strong, comprehensive bill, and we're really grateful for all the work that has gone into it. It's been a lot, and your obvious commitment to meeting the needs of Minnesotans. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Helden. It's great to hear kids in the background. Let's see, after Ms. Nelson on deck is Julia Birkstaller. So Ms. Nelson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Schultz and committee members. I'm Jillian Nelson. I'm the Community Resource and Policy Advocate for the Autism Society of Minnesota, and I'm also an autistic adult. The Autism Society exists to enhance the lives of individuals and families affected by autism spectrum disorder, and I want to thank you for the exceptional support for our community demonstrated in House File 4579. Proposals including changes to live in our own homes, for our PCAs to support us in transportation, the changes to PCA framework, and of course, the Disability Services Accessibility Task Force and Pilot Project. It is definitely a mouthful. I truly believe that this task force is the vital next step as we make gains to improve services and supports throughout the disability community. Because without an accessible system, there will continue to be inequitable access to these amazing and life-changing resources. There will continue to be trauma to disabled people and their families, and there will continue to be lives lost due to the inability to access services. If we as a state are committed to doing better for the disability community, one of the most impactful moves we can make is ensuring that the system that allows access to the meaningful and life-sustaining supports needed are accessible for everyone. Additionally, accessible changes that allow for decreased dependence on the appeal process or reduce crisis intervention will have a long-term fiscal impact on the disability service program. And we know well that the disability services and spending is a consistent discussion. If we increase accessibility, we can ensure that an increased amount of spending is going to serving people as opposed to unnecessary appeals. We strongly support the amendment to this task force to include representation from the Minnesota Commission of the Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing, as the work of this task force is only strengthened by the voices of multiple communities. Additionally, we are working with the department on approaches to pilot programs that address their concerns so we can move forward with a fiscal note. I would like to thank Representative Freiberg for his tireless work on this piece of legislation, as well as every other representative that has supported this task force. Your understanding and support validates the struggles our community faces daily in navigating the existing system. As a Minnesota that is serving this community through my work, and a Minnesotan that depends on these services to live a meaningful and productive life, I thank you for your support to improve this system by creating this task force. Your work will change lives, including my own. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. After Ms. Birkstaller, we have Jenny Kempfert on deck. Julia Birkstaller, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Julia Birkstaller, Public Policy Director for the ARC Minnesota. Thank you for all the work this session that you've done, drawing the much needed attention to the direct support professional workforce shortage, as well as the many complex issues impacting Minnesotans with disabilities statewide. We are grateful for many provisions in this omnibus bill, and it's a good problem to have so much to cover in such a little amount of time, so I'm gonna do my best. Thank you for the informed choice and remote options for reassessments, allowing flexibility in who can establish but not administer an ABLE account for an eligible individual, changes to permit people who access services in their own homes to appeal service terminations, correcting an imbalance in appeal rights for people accessing in-home services, establishment of and appropriations for the critical incident review team, the provision permitting PCAs to drive, expanding shared services to all home and community-based service waivers, which will help alleviate the staffing crisis for people who live in their own homes and who would like to share services and service providers, raising the 40-hour cap on PCA and CFSS services for parent caregivers, increases to the PCA rate framework implementation factor, the rate increase for employment exploration services. We must continue to invest in service options that support people with disabilities in finding competitive integrated employment. the Workforce Incentive Fund grants, the Direct Care Service Corps pilot project, the provision to establish life sharing services as a covered MA waiver service, the Task Force on Disability Services Accessibility and pilot projects, changes to the countable income for people accessing housing support services who also receive Social Security income. The housing support program is an important pathway for low-income individuals with disabilities to access affordable, accessible housing. And this change allows people to keep more of their income so that they do not have to make the difficult choice between paying rent and other basic living needs. The supported decision-making grants appropriation. And last but not least, support coordination training for case managers, which will give case managers more tools to work with people they support in developing plans to continue living in their own homes in spite of the instability in the workforce. And as you continue negotiations throughout the rest of this legislative session, we hope you'll consider including long overdue MAEPD reform in your omnibus bill, such as those changes that were included in House File 4273. The provision that addresses the regressive premium schedule for MAEPD has been included in the Senate's omnibus bill, and we hope there will be a robust discussion around this during conference. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Julia Burkstaller. On deck is Lorianne Granados. Let's see, Jenny Kempfert, welcome to the committee. State your name and proceed, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jenny Kempfert, and I'm the PCA Program Director for ARC Northland, located in Duluth. ARC Northland is a disability services organization serving eight counties in the Arrowhead region. One of the services we provide is PCA Choice, which supports over 200 individuals and employs over 300 workers. I also serve on the policy committee for the Minnesota First Provider Alliance, which is a statewide membership association for PCA provider agencies. The PCA program is a critical service that assists over 44,000 Minnesotans in their homes and communities. Historically, the PCA program has been one of the lowest reimbursed services, with a current reimbursement of just $19.60 an hour, which is much lower than similar type services. The PCA program is vital to ensuring that Minnesotans with disabilities and older adults can safely remain in their homes and avoid the need for more costly congregate care services. I appreciate this opportunity to provide testimony today in strong support of House File 4579, which, among other things, increases the implementation factor in the PCA CFSS rate framework from 75.45% to 79.5%. This increase builds on the PCA CFSS rate framework that was passed into law last session, and it recognizes that despite significant investments in the PCA program made in 2021, which were greatly appreciated, the service is still severely underfunded. The continued investment included in House File 4579 is essential to support the efforts of providers and people receiving services to recruit and retain workers by paying them living wages. We also appreciate the inclusion of raising the 40-hour weekly cap for parents of minors and spouses on the CDCS and CFSS programs. This too will help with the workforce crisis. And lastly, we appreciate the inclusion of the PCA driving bill language. The Provider Alliance believes that the House File 4579 is essential to ensuring the long-term viability of the PCA program, and we so appreciate your support today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jenny Kempfert. On deck, we have MACSI, Matt Freeman or Stacey Hennen. Next up is Lorianne Granados. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. I am Lorianne Granados, and I represent Accessible Space Incorporated, ASI. Not so much the organization, but our residents and the incredible staff who serve them. ASI is a provider of customized living services for some of Minnesota's most vulnerable adults. It's been our mission since 1978 to serve low-income adults with significant physical disabilities in a way that provides them the greatest degree of independence. Our 24/7 customized living model allows our residents to live in their own apartments with on-site assistance at a fraction of the cost of nursing home placement. We aren't a big warehouse or a huge facility. We have subsidized accessible apartment buildings in communities where our residents live with more independence than they ever dreamed possible. All of our residents rely on medical assistance to fund their services. Therefore, we don't have that mix of private pay or other payers to help balance out the low MA reimbursement rates. In recent years, we've struggled to continue to provide these services with no increase in our reimbursement rate in 8 years, and we're just simply unable to continue. We have lost hundreds of thousands of dollars in the past year alone. As a result, we've shuttered services in our locations in Minneapolis, Rochester, St. Cloud, and St. Paul. We're currently preparing to end services to all of our residents in Bloomington and Champlin, and our services to our residents in Duluth are in jeopardy due to an insufficient reimbursement rate. And without our services, most of these residents cannot continue to live in their own apartments. I'm here today to implore you to include providers of customized living services for caddy and brain injury clients in the 256S elderly waiver framework increase. We were absolutely devastated this winter when we found out that our caddy and brain injury services were not covered by the 9.7% DWRS increase, and that customized living providers serving individuals under these waivers were expressly carved out of the EW framework phase-in. ASI competes for the same staff and serves some of the most vulnerable populations, providing more complex care than many of the residential and home care service providers who saw their reimbursements increased in recent months. The 2021 bifurcation between the elderly waiver and the caddy and brain injury customized living reimbursement frameworks hit us hard, and it continues to put our residents' services at risk. We want to continue to serve these vulnerable adults, but we need a reimbursement rate that covers our cost of care. The reimbursement frameworks are not equitable, and they result in very disparate reimbursements for identical diagnoses and service plans. I implore you to include our residents under the caddy and brain injury waiver in the House and Human Services omnibus bill. The reimbursement relief cannot come soon enough for our residents. On behalf of our staff and our residents, we thank you for your consideration and your service to the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Granados. On deck is Aaron Hupert from Leading Age, but right now we either have Matt Freeman or Stacey Hennen.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, Ms. Hennen. Please state your name and proceed.
I'm Stacey Hennen. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators, or MACSA. I'm the director of Western Prairie Human Services, or formerly Pope and Grant Counties, and also of Traverse County Social Services, and I'm the legislative lead for MACSA. We wanted to take a moment to thank you for all of the opportunities for vulnerable and underserved Minnesotans that exist in House File 4579 and ask you to consider some additional things. We support provisions to fund a qualified individual program and continuous improvement related to the implementation of Family First and feel it will assist us in serving some of the most vulnerable people in Minnesota. We support the elements from Governor Walz's supplemental budget requesting to stabilize working families by aligning the Minnesota Family Investment Program with other assistance programs. We appreciate and support the investments in Parent Support Outreach Program, Family Group Decision Making, Family Assessment Response, Parent Mentors, and grants to counties and tribes to lower caseloads and support youth existing foster care. We're also supportive of investments in culturally responsive programming for our African American and Native American population to help address the impact of the child protection system on those populations. These are all programs that address the needs of children and family and strengthen our ability to respond throughout Minnesota, as well as building an infrastructure of services. MACSA supports the alignment of this bill with the National Opioid Settlement and the work of the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council towards the same end. We support the more than $75 million in emergency shelter facilities grants and $85 million for emergency services grants over the next 3 years. It will help tremendously as we work to move individuals and families into sustainable housing. And we support investing $77.5 million into modernization efforts to support the transformation of our service delivery system in an effort to make it more streamlined and person-centered for those accessing the services needed. We would respectfully ask that you consider the following things. In the $77.5 million investment in modernization, we ask that you consider the integrative platform ecosystem recommended by the Gardner Go Forward recommendations. These recommendations include counties and tribes in the development of new systems and recognizes the need for a shift to an agile approach to systems development. We appreciated working with legislators to address youth who are transitioning out of foster care, and we agree wholeheartedly that attention and resources are needed in this area. We recognize the complexities of implementing trusts and appreciate the conversations we've had with legislators to that end. We request that you consider the adult mental health initiatives and the sustainability of funding as they enter into formula changes that will cause reduced funding and resources in some parts of the state. Mental health services infrastructure is fragile and is held together in many ways by this funding. We fear that without further resources in this area, we will see greater gaps and disparities in services throughout Minnesota. We ask that you consider policy language and funding that would secure these dollars and therefore further secure our infrastructure and, at a minimum, prevent the loss of funds to areas of the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hennen. On deck, we have Toby Pearson. Up now is Erin Hubert. Welcome. State your name and proceed, please.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Erin Hubert, Vice President of Advocacy for Leading Age Minnesota, and here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative to share our opposition to Article 5 of the bill, which creates a Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board. My colleague, Toby Pearson, who's on deck, will testify on the articles and sections that we do appreciate the committee has included in their bill. I think I would say, if you had asked me 30 days ago what I thought about long-term care, I would have said that it was intended to be a safety net for seniors and their families, a system designed to allow seniors to age in accordance with their values and their health needs, whether that was at home, through assisted living, or even in a nursing home. And I find myself a month later wanting that to be true. And as I think about my own parents who are in their mid-70s, I can't honestly promise them that the system will be there without your support. We have 23,000 open positions within long-term care, and that is across all areas: housekeeping, dietary, direct care staff, management. 40% of our members aren't sure that they can meet cash flow needs beyond 1 month if their primary source of payment, the state, is delayed because they've already spent their reserves, they've spent their ARPA and CARES support, and they've extended lines of credit. 15 nursing homes have closed since 2019, 4 since January of this year. And the reality is that COVID-19 has exposed the vulnerabilities of long-term care payment, even with the value-based reform system that passed in 2015, and there is zero funding for nursing homes in this bill. I think we all have the same goal. We want to increase wages to our caregivers so that they are fairly compensated and recognized for their service in senior care. However, instead of creating an appointed 9-person commission that requires nursing homes to increase staffing or improve wages, we really implore you to provide support through its structural investments that will actually enable us to meet that shared goal. It is also with a sense of urgency and the magnitude of our workforce crisis that I share the imperative's caution with Article 2, Section 35, which provides the workforce incentive grants. While we really appreciate these grants, one-time incentives will not be enough to secure the promise of senior care for our loved ones when 20% of our workforce is already gone. Again, we urge you to invest in permanent solutions for long-term caregiver wages, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Erin Hubert. On deck, we have Eric Grumdahl, but next up is Toby Pearson. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. We have testified in committee about providers struggling with staffing, occupancy, and census. As Ms. Hubert stated, we have testified about staffing, saying we have about somewhere between 23 and 25,000 open positions, which is about 20% of our workforce. In the fall, we were losing about 1,500 workers per month. In occupancy, we testified about our staff shortages contributing to ongoing steep drops down to about 65%. Normally, we run somewhere between 85 and 90%. 75% of the nursing homes are limiting admissions. Some cases, entire counties don't have available beds. In cash flow, as Ms. Hubert pointed out, basically, we testified we're circling the drain. When we look at the bill before you, we are disappointed to see very little that will alleviate our problems in long-term care, specifically for nursing homes. But we do see a couple positive things. The positive things that we want to thank you for including are the phase-in of the elderly waiver payment system, the virtual adult day language, as well as the implementation on PACE. We stand ready to work with you and the department to try to improve the bill to help fund nursing homes. Thank you.
Thank you, Toby Pearson. On deck, we have Don Simonson. Next up is Eric Grumdahl. Welcome, and please proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Schultz and members. For the record, I'm Eric Grumdahl, Deputy Director of the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness. I'm here in support of the investments in housing stability you included from the governor's budget proposal. These investments will significantly advance statewide efforts to prevent and end homelessness. I want to call attention to several proposals you included. First, despite measurable progress on many aspects of homelessness, the number of Minnesotans staying outdoors has grown consistently. In 2020, 2.5 times more Minnesotans were without shelter compared to 2014. The investments in the Emergency Services Program, Shelter Facilities Capital Grants, Transitional Housing Program, and Homeless Youth Act will go a long way toward addressing those needs, and we're grateful you've included those proposals in your bill. Second, the proposal on addressing deep poverty will fix the dwindling earning power of the General Assistance Program for adults in extreme poverty and unable to work, and help them sustain housing situations that prevent more people from appearing at the shelter door. Third, we're grateful that you've included the governor's budget proposal to establish parity in our response to substance abuse and mental health challenges for people experiencing homelessness. The expansion of the PATH and the Housing Supports for Adults with Serious Mental Illness programs will connect people in crisis to the support for recovery and help them achieve success in stable housing. As conversations proceed throughout the session, we hope the legislature will consider the governor's other homelessness proposals, including small investments that contribute significantly to our response. These include the AmeriCorps Heading Home Corps, which establishes a workforce pipeline and a career opportunity for people exiting homelessness who serve as navigators to connect people in crisis with the resources on their journey back to housing stability. Second, the most effective responses to homelessness are grounded in understanding each person's situation and are accountable for using taxpayer investments wisely. The governor's proposal for the Homeless Management Information System is a critical way state programs do that. Finally, the governor proposed sustaining responses funded by the temporary enhanced FMAP reimbursement. The funding cliff facing those services threatens whether these program improvements, like being able to cover move-in costs as people return to housing, can continue. Thank you for the position your committee's taken in support of Minnesotans facing extreme housing challenges, for your leadership, and for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Grumdahl. On deck is Kathy Meserly. Up next is Don Simonson. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. My name is Don Simonson, and I am the CEO of Trellis, the Metropolitan Region's Area Agency on Aging. And I'm here today to speak to a dire shortage in funding for home-delivered meals for older adults. As we know, seniors have been heavily impacted by the pandemic, and many continue to self-isolate as they have chronic disease. That makes them vulnerable to hospitalization and poor outcomes of COVID-19. Now, the need for home-delivered meals has been accelerating for some time due to the growth in the older population, and the pandemic has put that demand in overdrive. Where we rarely had wait lists prior to the pandemic, we saw wait lists form over the past 2 years, and they are growing, even with the influx of federal emergency and stimulus funding. As an area agency on aging, we've obligated all of the resources we have available, including in contractual commitments to our four providers in 2022. We've had to reduce funding to these providers by almost $3.4 million compared to 2021. As of January, here in the metro alone, 373 older adults are waiting for meals in the metro region. The Minnesota Association of Area Agencies on Aging put forward a bill authored by Representative Kelly Mahler and Senator Karen Housley to provide short-term bridge funding of $5 million to be distributed statewide. Now, our bill did not receive a hearing, and I'm here today to ask you to include $5 million in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. This could potentially be an increase to the food support grants. This is line 339.26. We understand while these funds are generally intended for free food shelves, food banks, and meal programs, our nonprofit network would be eligible to apply. We believe that's the case. This would be a very streamlined way to increase funding so that we would not face cutting people from home-delivered meal service, reducing meals to them, and we would be able to make a dent in our wait lists. Now, the current state funding for senior nutrition programs is $2.695 million annually, and that funding has been flat for decades. The federal appropriation is also flat. I'm sure that we all do not want frail or food insecure older adults to go without meals that they need to stay in their community homes. This is a smart investment for the state. Home-delivered meals are a foundational home and community-based service. They support independent living. They slow or prevent spend down to Medicaid and help people avoid premature nursing home placement. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Simonson. On deck, we have Sue Abderholden, but up next is Kathy Meserly. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Schultz and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Meserly, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Home Care Association. Our association represents members who provide hands-on care to more than 30,000 members, or 30,000 older Minnesotans, excuse me, and individuals with disabilities in their homes. MHCA greatly appreciates the investments that are proposed in the House Human Services Omnibus Bill that move us toward our shared goal as policymakers, advocates, and service providers to increase access to the services to support older Minnesotans and those with complex care needs to remain living in their own homes and or with their families as long as possible. The provisions that will enhance access to care include reforming the reimbursement system for certain homemaker services, establishing reimbursement for home care, care evaluation visits, more fully implementing the data-driven rate reimbursement system for the personal care assistance program, allowing a personal assistant to be reimbursed for the time spent driving a recipient, establishment of workforce incentive grant funds, and lastly, more fully funding the elderly waiver rate system. We are also appreciative of the language in the bill allowing for reimbursement for a limited number of care coordination units, and we look forward to working with the committee on this provision as we learn more about the fiscal note. These provisions will help our state to better support Minnesotans in need of home care services by increasing access to the services and recognizing the invaluable role that home care staff play. Thank you for the opportunity to provide this testimony and for your investment in home and community-based services.
Thank you, Kathy Meserly. On deck is Al Fletcher, but next up we have Sue Abderholden. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Abderholden. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. And we're frankly really grateful for the policy proposals and the funding that is in this bill that will help address the crisis we are facing in our mental health system. The World Health Organization reported just last week that depression and anxiety have increased 25% worldwide. And we know that our children and youth are particularly struggling. And so at a time when we have increased needs, we actually have a system that cannot respond. So some of the parts of the bill that we think will be helpful is first addressing workforce issues. So including mental health providers in the workforce incentive grants will really help. We also appreciate the funding for the mental health provider supervision grant and also putting into statute the cultural and ethnic minority infrastructure grant program with additional funds. And I think it's important to point out that not only do we provide more culturally responsive services through these providers, but we build the capacities of BIPOC agencies and their workforce. There's some smaller things like allowing DBT to be used for youth under the age of 18 that will really help. But also creating crisis homes for kids. We don't have them. We have them for adults, but not for kids. And as you know, we have children who are boarding in the emergency rooms, and not because they can't be assessed. They are being assessed in the emergency rooms. It's that they're waiting for the level of care that they need. They're waiting for a hospital bed. They're waiting for a residential facility. And actually, if we can add these crisis homes, they will have a place to go, which we think is really important. We appreciate the focus on the emerging, you know, first psychotic episode programs. We actually need 8 in Minnesota. We have 4. And when we can prevent one of the most serious mental illnesses, schizophrenia, from becoming disabling for a young adult, field. I think we're doing good work. We also appreciate really looking at developing an emerging mood disorder program. Bipolar disorder and serious depression can also be really difficult for a young adult 18 to 26. And if we can provide those same intensive services, we can perhaps change the trajectory of their life. We appreciate expanding respite care services to foster families. We think that's great. Transitioning from homeless programs or providing case management and outreach. We also appreciate the funding and the language around locked ERTS facilities. We know, and we've worked with Representative Albright, and we now have an agreement on the competency restoration bill. We can't really address the issues in that system without having a place in the community for people to go. And so we need to have some locked ERTS facilities so that people can also be secure and safe in the community as well. Addressing the issue with overnight staff in our psychiatric residential treatment facilities will also help. There is a staffing crisis. People are going to make more working at, frankly, a fast food restaurant than helping kids with serious mental illnesses in our residential facilities. So this will really help. And I think the startup funds, hopefully we can get some more facilities opening. We also support expanding intensive treatment and foster care to any family with a child who's at risk of out-of-home placement. Although I will say that I think we have to stop saying out-of-home placement, and we have to start saying the level of care that a child needs. When we use out-of-home placement, we are really using child protection language instead of treatment language. We do hope that at some time in the future, we can work with DHS to figure out a workaround on the Youth Act issue, changing the age from 26 down to 21. While some youth at that age will transfer to an Adult Act team, not all will, and we need to find a workaround for that issue. We appreciate the funding for things like expanding mobile crisis so that we don't have to rely on a police response to a mental health crisis, increasing the rates for adult treatment before more of them close, the shelter leaked funding, also looking at the funding for inpatient psychiatric care, the funding for rural providers as well to expand their workforce, and the funding for traditional healing. So there is a lot in this bill. And again, we really appreciate it because, as you all know, we have increased need and decreased availability. And this is not something that's going to go away. And we can either invest in our mental health system or invest in our criminal justice system. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. On deck is Lorna Schmidt. Next up is Al Fletcher. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and then proceed with your testimony. Let's see, Mr. Fletcher, are you here with us?
Yes.
Please proceed. Oh. Please state your name. You're up now. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony, please, Mr. Fletcher.
Sure. My name is Al Fletcher, and I'm a parent of a child in the ACR Homes group home system. I'm speaking today on behalf of a lot of parents. I'm thinking there might be as many as 40,000 parents and guardians representing their children that are in, there are over 8,000 group homes in Minnesota. And these are the individuals that are, they have such severe disabilities that they cannot live in their own home and benefit from PCA services. And because of the severe workforce shortage that we are all quite aware of, group homes have been closing. And in fact, in the last 6 months, 60 group homes have closed in Minnesota. And if the rate continues, if nothing changes, that could represent 150 homes closed by the end of 2022, which would be in the neighborhood of 600 very severely disabled individuals out of that type of placement. And they're too young. They don't qualify for nursing homes because they're underage, they're adults that are under age 65. But if you think of nursing homes, people who need that serious level of care, that's the individuals that have to live in a group home. And when a group home closes, the individuals are forced out. And in the past, space within the group home system and other homes, some of these, they could fit into those homes, if that makes sense. But now that slack is all taken up, and there just are very few places yet to go. And we've been very pleased with the support that this committee has provided in House File 3100 up to date, but then, and in the omnibus bill, when that came out, it did include the workforce, competitive workforce factor. But now in the amendment, that entire section is deleted. And it's totally confusing to us why this committee would, in fact, suddenly change that and delete it. And that would result in the language that's in statute for the wage rate setting formulas to revert to what is already there, which uses 30-month-old, 2.5-year-old competitive workforce data. And so you can just imagine how outdated that is. At present and leading up to these closures in the last few months, the wage rate was approximately $15 an hour, and we were hoping to get it up to around 20. I was happy to hear a few minutes ago that the reimbursement rate for PCAs is over $19 an hour. So even if direct service providers' wages came up to that, that would be a big improvement from where they are now. So that pretty much summarizes my testimony. I appreciate Chair Schultz and the committee for giving me an opportunity to speak on behalf of the parents of group homes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fletcher. On deck, we have Mary Jo George, but next up is Lorna Schmidt. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lorna Schmidt, and I'm the Public Policy Manager with Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis. I'm here to call attention to and express our thanks for the strong package of investments recommended by the Preventing Homelessness Division that's included in your omnibus bill under Articles 11 and 15. COVID did a good job of pointing out the inadequacies of our state's emergency shelter system, but it also helped show the impact that is possible when investments are scaled to the true scope of the need and when partners are aligned and coordinated in their response. Multiple investments included here would help ensure that as we move beyond the pandemic, we are moving forward and not backwards. The bill makes significant ongoing investments in the things that we know work, providing funding for shelter operations and day services with the Emergency Services Program, the Homeless Youth Act, and shelter-linked mental health grants. It provides one-time funding to support the transition of temporary shelter supports that were put in place as part of Hennepin and Ramsey's regional response efforts during the pandemic. This will help avert a funding cliff that otherwise threatens to displace hundreds of vulnerable individuals while more deeply affordable housing units come online. And it reforms systems to correct current flaws that are limiting our impact by changing housing support income calculations so that veterans and individuals with disabilities aren't forced to pay more than 30% of their benefits on housing. This critical change would address financial barriers that are currently deterring moves out of shelter and that are creating roadblocks for those working toward greater housing and financial independence. These are smart investments and reforms that give us the tools to disrupt trends in homelessness in our state. And with thousands of Minnesotans experiencing homelessness every night, the time to make them really is now. We thank you for your support, and we're looking forward to working with you throughout the remaining session to see these investments through.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. On deck is Danny Ackert, but next up is Mary Jo George. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name, affiliation, and then proceed.
Hi there. Sorry about that. Good morning, Chair Schultz and members of the committee. My name is Mary Jo George, and I'm the Associate State Director of Advocacy for AARP Minnesota. On behalf of AARP's 630,000 statewide members, we appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning. AARP strongly supports the investments in home and community-based services that offer seniors more choices and saves taxpayers money, as in-home care costs one-third of nursing home care on average in Medicaid. These investments will undoubtedly address the workforce crisis in these settings and put Medicaid's long-term care spending more in line with people's priorities for independence. These investments include increases to programs that seniors who are living in their homes rely on, including the Elderly Waiver Program, the Personal Care Attendant Program, consumer-directed
community supports, and critical non-medical assistance programs, including alternative care and essential community supports. At the same time, however, it's essential that older Minnesotans have access to these programs in a timely manner. So we were disappointed that the bill did not include the presumptive eligibility proposal, which would fast track applicants likely eligible for Medicaid to start receiving services in their homes when the need arises. Without it, seniors who often prefer home care are often transferred to a nursing home instead due to our lengthy eligibility process. In addition, given the historic budget surplus, we do believe the gravity of the workforce crisis will require additional resources and investments to protect residents in nursing homes. We believe new investments tied directly to workers' wages, quality outcomes, and accountability to taxpayers will go a long way in helping to recruit and retain dedicated, hardworking individuals in these homes. Finally, AARP wants to support the increasing the eligibility up to 200% of poverty for the SNAP benefits. This program reduces food insecurity and poverty and is linked to improved health outcomes, including reduced hospitalizations among low-income older adults. This small but significant change can help improve the food security for the 50-plus population. So in conclusion, AARP wants to thank you for these very important investments. However, we hope to continue to work with you throughout this session to work on issues around investments in nursing homes and presumptive eligibility. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. George, for your testimony. On deck is Brian Solvita. Next up is Danny Eckert. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and your affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, everyone and members of the committee. My name is Danny Eckert with the Minnesota Hospital Association. The demand for mental and behavioral health care services across the entire spectrum of care in Minnesota is at an all-time high. And unfortunately, hospitals and health systems can attest that the increase in demand they are experiencing is uniquely acute amongst children and adolescent patients. Subsequently, the current healthcare workforce crisis, along with additional compounding factors resulting from COVID-19, have drained the supply of desperately needed mental and behavioral health care for all Minnesotans. Hospitals and health systems directly provide many comprehensive mental and behavioral health services. They also assist in coordinating care through an equal number of vital partnerships with other providers and entities. Such partnerships allow for transitions between the various levels of care that best serve the patient and ensure better outcomes through appropriate and necessary care. Currently, hospitals and health systems are experiencing ongoing challenges with the timely discharge of mental health patients of all ages to residential care facilities and other care provider locations. This reflects not only the demand on hospitals and health systems, but also the demand on all types of mental and behavioral health care providers, as well as the dwindling supply of available care. Given the current perilous state of demand outweighing supply, MHA supports many provisions in House File 4579 that we see as much needed support to keep the full spectrum of mental and behavioral health care as strong as possible. Specifically, we support the significant workforce revitalization provisions in Article 2, especially the investments in mental health provider recruitment grants and behavioral health workforce incentive grants. And we support the various provisions in Article 3 pertaining to policy changes and investments in expanding children's residential treatment and psychiatric residential treatment facilities, mobile crisis services for children, expanding intensive treatment for children in foster care, and children's residential crisis stabilization. In closing, Minnesota's hospitals and health systems are hopeful that the legislature will provide much needed support to ensure that all Minnesotans have access to the mental and behavioral health care they need when they need it. With that, I thank you all for hearing my testimony, and I will answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Eckert. On deck is Chuck Hilder. Next up is Brian Solvita. Please proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Brian Solvita, and I am the Regional Director for Behavioral Health Group, the largest provider of outpatient opioid treatment in Minnesota with approximately 3,000 Minnesotans currently under our care. I'm here to speak in opposition of the governor's proposal entitled Opioid Treatment Programs Rate Integrity, found in Article 3, Sections 22, 57, and 92. To be clear, the proposal does not tweak an existing system to add oversight and transparency, but instead replaces the existing rate system with an entirely new one, with both a new billing structure and new rates. Based on our analysis, the proposed rate system would result in over a 30% rate cut for the average medical assistance methadone patient that we serve. This cut would have a significant impact on our ability to continue to provide treatment to Minnesotans. Various rate models used by other states and Medicare achieve DHS stated goals of transparency and accountability without destroying the structure of the supports for those dealing with the opioid addiction. These models combine the rate structure, how services are paid for, to financially sustainable rates. Unfortunately, this is not the case with this proposal. The proposal appears to be based on flawed assumptions, limited cost data, and systemic averages, a combination that is a recipe for disaster. Behavioral Health Group is not opposed to sensible rate reform. As noted, there are better solutions, and we are committed to finding them working with DHS and other interested stakeholders. However, at this time, I would ask you to reject the current governor's proposal. Thank you for your consideration and your commitment to addressing the opioid crisis that we are facing in our community.
Thank you, Ms. Swoboda. On deck, we have Brian Zerbes. Up next is Chuck Hilger. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name, affiliation, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Charles Hilger. I'm a licensed alcohol drug counselor, a consultant to OTP programs. I'm the current vice president of MARCH, and I've worked with OTPs for 19 years, opening programs across the state and expanding OTP services. Today, I'd like to briefly address the changes to the opioid treatment program rate methodology and the proposed rates. The existing OTP rate methodology for Minnesota has been in place and working well for the last 20 years. Over the last 2 years, DHS has made various claims that the OTPs are being compensated for patients self-administering medications at home. And since this would not be allowable under state or federal laws, that rate reform for OTPs is necessary. What you need to know is that an OTP has never been compensated for patients self-administering medication at home because it was never part of the state's own rate methodology developed by the department. The OTP rate methodology, often referred to as a blended rate, was created by the department to take into consideration that some patients use more services than others. The duration of treatment for an OTP is typically about 2.5 years. And it calculates the average amount of services for the average patient in time, which includes all counseling, medical services, medication costs, mental health services, and so forth. The amount of costs that was gathered during the study was simply divided by the number of days to arrive at what's considered a per diem rate or a daily rate, which is what we've had in place for 20 years. Currently, the rate is $13.39 per day. So that means when a patient comes to the program, they'll receive multiple services, and the charge to the state for the provider is $13.39. Or perhaps they come to the program, receive medication, and just take home 2 days of medication. The state does receive the same $13.39 per day for those 2 days because it's an average rate. It's not because the patient self-administers the medication at home, which is what the department has largely been claiming lately. It's because the patient is enrolled and participating in treatment, which just is billed out at a bundled rate. We disagree with the department's assertion that OTPs are compensated when patients self-administer medication and the need for OTP rate reform. We are opposed to the department's current rate proposal, which slashes compensation to OTPs by as much as 40% while requiring them to provide the same level of care. The proposed rate reduction will force programs to reduce access for state-funded patients or close programs altogether when they are needed the most. Providers understand that the department has a goal to have medication costs separated from the costs associated with providing behavioral health services. And we believe that there are workable solutions. Providers are open to adopting existing Medicare OTP service rates for medication as well as the behavioral health programming, which funds programs at about the same level that they receive now. We're also willing to work with the department to find other reasonable solutions to achieve their goals of maintaining access and quality care to the OTP system. Thank you very much for the time, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Hilger. On deck, we have Kurt Rutzen, but next up is Brian Zerbes. Welcome to the committee or welcome back. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Brian Zerbes with North Star Behavioral Health, and I'm here representing MARCH's Government Affairs Committee. MARCH is the state's largest substance disorder trade group, representing more than 70 organizations and hundreds of licensed programs throughout the state. The Pathways to Recovery bill was developed with input from hundreds of clients and scores of clinicians from substance disorder programs from across the state. The focus of the bill was aimed to address three components. One, to support and address clients' needs during and after treatment, such as allowing guest speakers. Number two was to address the substance disorder workforce by allowing continuity for interns on a path to licensure, having current training on HIV, having flexibility in residential treatment hours, and meeting co-occurring staffing requirements. And number three, regarding service access and preservation, such as expanding options for withdrawal management programs, clarifying documentation timeline requirements, providing documentation relief for treatment planning, adding substance disorder reimbursement rates to an existing annual DHS report, and extending the deadline for the paperwork reduction report. I'm offering this testimony to acknowledge the absence of the Pathways to Recovery content and to express our concern that it wasn't included. Up to this point, there has been broad bipartisan support of these remaining items in the Pathways to Recovery bill. We're hopeful that the Senate positions can be adopted in conference, and we're very grateful for Representative Frederick for championing this cause, as well as for the continued engagement and support from Chair Fisher, Representatives Frankie, Representative Baker, and many others. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Zerbes. On deck is Barbara Moon, but up next is Kurt Rutzen. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope you can hear me okay. My name is Kurt Rutzen. I'm a disability advocate. The situation that we're facing in the disability community, the staff shortage is, to say it's in crisis is an understatement. Right now, there are disability people at their homes or group homes that are dying because staff doesn't show up or they take another job at McDonald's that are less responsible and that pay more. So if we don't care about the disability people in Minnesota, let's just say, and let's let them die, go on with our lives, and I guess that would be fine. But I don't believe that you all are that heartless. We need more funding and a lot more funding. And I just want to, not everyone's like me. There are several conditions that make people higher risk, functioning, you name it. I got out of bed this morning all by myself. I live alone. I drive my own car. I'm so, so grateful. And I'm very thankful that I can do that. Many, many, many people can't do that. And let them in their homes or group homes dying because staff don't show up. It's a reality. It's unacceptable. Very, very sad and heartbreaking. So like I stated before, in closing, if we don't care about these people, let's hold the money back and let them die and go on with our own lives. If you're okay with that, then do that. But I know you guys care. And in closing, I want to thank you to mention letting me testify. And I appreciate all of you, and I really do. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Rutzen, and I know you had testified earlier. We really appreciate your comments today. On deck is Lynn Sansale, I believe, but next up is Barbara Moon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony. Do we have Barbara Moon with us today?
I'm
you
here.
Are, Barbara. Oh, please state your name and then proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Well, I'm on my son's iPad, so you all are lucky you get Scooby-Doo today. So anyway, my name is Barbara Moon, and good morning, everyone. And I'd like to thank you for letting me testify today and share my story. My 32-year-old son, Joe, lived in an ACR home with four people for about 5 years. And Joe has cerebral palsy. He uses an electric wheelchair and has very high medical needs. In his home, there was a staff to client ratio of 2 clients to 1 staff. But in mid-January of this year, Joe received a 60-day termination notice. His group home was closing due to staff shortages and not being able to keep that ratio. Joe's group home closed on March 14th, so Joe moved out, luckily, into another home with a different company on that same exact day. This was an ICF home, an intermediate care facility, which is a 6-person home, and that is considered an institution. This home had a ratio of 2 staff to 3 clients. The new home, I feel, really gave it a good go, but the direct care staff just couldn't handle the needs of my son. After a couple of serious negligent issues, one of which was very life-threatening, and after 4 days, we decided for the safety of Joe, it was best to pull him out of this home. Where did he go? Where did we take him? Well, we took him back to our home. My husband and I are in our 60s, and though my husband is still working full-time, we are in transition mode and planning for our retirement future, and our home is supposed to go up for sale this next week, but because we're in the process of moving into a small retirement home we purchased 2 years ago, we had, and you know, most of our stuff was at that other house. At the retirement home, it was easy and fairly easy for Joe to come in and take over the living room, and in this old house, and the sunroom took all his supplies, the many needed supplies and treatments.
I'm the one that provides most of the direct care for my son, but I too have my own health issues. It becomes very difficult at times for me. We do pay out for help about three nights a week for a few hours. It's not just the group homes that are closing their doors. It's everywhere that provides services for the most vulnerable people. We have looked into placement and day programs, into day programs for Joe, but most are not up and running yet because the staff shortage is the same all over. This is a major crisis, and it's not going to get better unless wages are increased. I talked with one program director from a day program, and he said they have 75 people waiting for them to open back up, and we just don't have the staff. No one wants to work for the small wages we can pay. 2 months ago, our family was featured, this was February 7th, on a WCCO Channel 4 TV story. They did about our son and our family, about the effects of closing the group home had on us. The story was also a plea for wage increases that was needed for staffing in the healthcare field for vulnerable people like Joe. Since that story aired on the news, I've talked to many parents that have adult children in group homes. Many of them that are older, that had their adult child's group home closed and didn't know what to do. They could not care for their child at home. They were scared about the future of their loved ones, and they were scared about their own future as they get older and more vulnerable and might need care for themselves, or they needed care for themselves right now. I know I've given this some thought. Any of us at any time could be in the situation, or a loved one of ours could be in the situation. And of course, we would want the best care for them. So, well, I have an idea. Why don't we just reward people for working with disabled and senior communities? Reward them with a living wage that will attract them to this field of work and retain them. My son Joe is sitting right over here too. So maybe it will become their forever job. Give them some, well, give people like Joseph some stability. Give them, well, give the people stability to our vulnerable community. And I'm going to say this word, please. Please, by offering people a significant wage increase, I guarantee people will be rewarded, not just with the monetary aspect, but they will feel the rewards of working with people so special. People like my son, Joseph. We need to do it because it's just the right thing to do. It really is. Thank you. Thank you for listening today.
Thank you, Ms. Moon. And I don't believe we have any other testifiers.
I was asked to read Lynn's by Colby.
Can you submit that in writing to us, please?
Yes, but I cannot read that now. I cannot read that.
Ms. Moon, is it short? Or is it something we should read? Is it a long letter?
It's about as long as mine, maybe.
Please proceed, Ms. Moon, and can you please state the name of the person who wrote the statement?
I will do that.
Thank you, Ms. Moon.
Because of the WCCO piece that my family did, Lynn Sansale, who this is, and her husband reached out to me, one of the parents, and we've built a friendship, and this is a wonderful letter, and this is about her daughter. So I'm going to read it as written by Lynn. My name is Lynn Sansale. My husband and I have a daughter, Jenny, who has cerebral palsy, is in a wheelchair, is nonverbal, does some signing, understands everything you are saying to her, and is one of the bravest people I know. She had a wonderful life in her group home for the past 20 years until ACR Homes sent us a termination letter we received in January, midway through her 25-day hospitalization for pancreatitis. At that time, we were spending 12-hour days with her at Fairview Ridges Hospital. Because there was no other place for her when she left her group home, she came home to us for 24 days. We asked ACR for a couple hours of training in our home on the Hoyer lift and her stander, both pieces of equipment that can be complicated and awkward, but no training was provided. I'm going to add this piece in here. They're 73 years old. We worked with Jenny's social worker to try to find professional support, but there were no people available to hire from any agency to come into our home to help us. We turned an alcove in our main floored bedroom to give Jenny sponge baths on a yoga table in our kitchen. It was an extremely difficult few weeks, and we are exhausted. She moved this past Monday, the 4th, to an ICF intermediate care facility, much different than her group home. She no longer has the ratio of help she requires and is now spread among a cohort of 6 people. I want to add that Jenny was lucky to be born in 1975 following the passage of the Developmental Disabilities Act of 1970, and at that time when things were changing for people with disabilities. In 1987, when Jenny was 12, I was fortunate to be one of the 30 parents of children with disabilities chosen for a pilot program called Partners in Policymaking. It was started by Clean Wick, the executive director of the Minnesota Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities. But what I remember the most from the first weekend session of Partners was the figure we learned it costs to run a state hospital, the cost per day for each resident to have this kind of care. Comparing this figure to the estimates of the cost of providing housing in their own communities made us realize change should and could happen. Partners brought the very best people from all over the country in the field of disabilities to teach us how we could help make change. We took this inspiration as they sent us to Washington, D.C. to join others that gathered from all over the country to talk with lawmakers about Medicaid reform. And later, thanks to the efforts of so many and Medicaid reform, people began to bloom in their communities and real change began. That's why it's so hard for me to watch it all collapse. The day Paul and I moved Jenny to this ICF, considered institutional care, was one of the hardest, most emotional days of our lives. No longer can Jenny come to our house every Tuesday for the afternoon and supper, as they certainly don't have staff to drive her. Everything in her care is different. I wrote to each of you and the rest of her story so you can get a better understanding of what her real life is like today compared to it in her previous home. So we are asking Minnesota lawmakers to follow through with their statements and promises to start working on ways to find new success by changing the system, providing safeguards that actually work this time in order to protect Jenny and others' rights following all of these tragedies. There are so many people who love working in this field but find it impossible to stay. Those that work with individuals with disabilities do hard but important work that needs to be adequately paid, a wage that meets this demanding but honorable and highly necessary work. Direct care staff also needs to be compensated fairly along with this living wage. There are many caregivers, advocacy programs, and parents rooting for you, ready to work with you and problem solve. Minnesota used to be a model for the rest of the country in this area. Please make changes possible and help us put a system back together so Jenny and all others like her that had their lives turned upside down can find a way to go home again, to a home that meets their needs and is reflected of freedom, independence, and quality of life each person with disabilities and a citizen of Minnesota deserves.
Thank you, Ms. Thank Moon, you. And thank you for reading Lynn Sansale's letter. We appreciate
it.
We have one more testifier. We have Amanda Vikstrom. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Schultz and members of the committee. I'm Amanda Vikstrom. I'm the executive director at the Minnesota Elder Justice Center, and we are a statewide nonprofit organization that provides support and advocacy services to victims of elder abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation. Thank you for the variety of approaches to serve older and vulnerable adults through this bill. There are several parts that we strongly support. First, the policy proposals in Article 6, Sections 28 to 40 from Representative Fredericks, HF 1432. These represent the first phase of adult protection modernization. We've talked to you about this bill throughout this session. Since the Vulnerable Adult Act was written over 40 years ago, we know much more about how to serve older and vulnerable adults at risk of maltreatment. And these policy changes are a valuable first step towards modernization. But systemic solutions will require more work. We would have liked to seen a Representative Knorr's bill, HF 3852, to provide grants to APS included to support these policy changes. APS is funded and supported at a much lower rate than child protection, and we encourage adding APS investments to this budget bill. Representative Knorr's bill would help develop creative solutions to the longstanding inequity issues within the APS system, so it's better to better shape DHS's adult protection redesign process in future years. Next, we are also supportive of the investments to address the staffing crisis in long-term care and the broad investments in in-home and community-based services, which are designed to keep older and vulnerable adults in their own homes. This bill is a good start in addressing the crisis, but we do agree with many providers and other advocates that more long-term wage increases in nursing homes and other long-term care settings combined with benefits will help retain workforce for the long term. And finally, we believe it's critical to invest in our senior nutrition program as proposed in Representative Mueller's bill, HF 4633, and as testified about earlier today from the AAAs and Don Simonson. And this funding is critical to help reduce senior hunger and social isolation. And both are key risk factors for older adults experiencing maltreatment. So the Minnesota Elder Justice Center plans to continue our work with others to address the structural inequities within APS and other systems. And we thank you for your work with this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Vikstrom. We are through the list of testifiers. I want to thank all of them for reading through our bill and for pointing out things that they appreciate and things they have concerns with. As you know, every year we are trying to increase reimbursement rates, and now with wage inflation, it's really vital. So I know our caucus has been very supportive of voting on bills like last year that made historic investments in reimbursement rate increases. And we try to do reimbursement rate increases, which will lead to higher wages every year with the limited budget we have. So I encourage everyone here who's advocating for wage increases, which I fully support and I know our members support, advocate with the GOP Senate to increase their budget target, increase their spending in health and human services, as we know how vital it is to provide these services and to have caring professionals care for our most vulnerable. So members, we're gonna take a 15-minute recess and come back at about 10:20. And I just wanna give everybody a break, but we still do have a hard stop at noon. And we have several amendments to go through, and then we'll re-refer the omnibus bill to Ways. So with that, members, we're gonna recess until 10:20. Thank you. Okay, welcome back. I'm gonna call back Human Services, Finance, and Policy to order. Members, really appreciate you allowing everyone to have a bit of a break. I just want the public to be aware that our staff, nonpartisan and partisan staff, have been working nonstop on our omnibus bills. And of course, the HHS bill is rather large and very complex, and they've gotten very little sleep. So I hope you will recognize their work somehow and thank them for all their dedication and devotion to the people of Minnesota. The next item on our agenda is that we have, now remember, we have the omnibus DE in front of us, and I'm going to move to amend this DE with my authors. And the DE is titled A22-0415. I'm going to amend that and offer the A5. So I will move the A5 amendment to the DE amendment and offer discussion. I know Representative Albright. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would move to divide the A5.
Okay, Representative Albright, I want you to go very slowly so everyone can follow your motion to divide the A5 amendment.
Certainly, Madam Chair.
Please proceed.
The motion is to divide the H4579A5 amendment, divide it before line 2.5 and after line 2.11 and before line 6.16 and after line 6.29, and motion to vote on those sections together. And I would request a roll call.
Okay, Representative Albright. So are there, is this correct that there are would be five sections of the A5 amendment to vote on?
Madam Chair, the first vote that would make appropriate sense would be on the sections between 2.5 and 2.11, including then lines 6.16 through 6.29, just those two sections.
Okay, we're going to find out if this is possible, but first I'll take comments from members. Chair Liebling.
Thanks, Madam Chair. That was just my question. I mean, I know we can divide amendments and so on, but I've never seen that we would take two chunks of an amendment and vote on them together. I've just never seen that at all. So I think we might need perhaps some advice from nonpartisan staff. Normally when these things happen on the floor, we have the chief clerk and the chief clerk gives us an opinion and then we all know that that's the definitive answer. But since we're not on the floor, I think we need to see if that is permissible. That's just, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Let's see, we'll have Daniel Pinelli, our nonpartisan research staff, provide us input on this potential division of the A5 amendment. Ms. Pinelli?
Hi, Madam Chair. I think the chair can allow such a motion if it's clear to the committee what's included in the amendment and if it can be clearly described. So in this instance, I think what Representative Albright is asking is for lines 2.5 to 2.11 and lines 6.16 to 6.29 to be voted on together. And I believe that all of those lines are related to removing sections from the bill that are related to the disability waiver rate system.
Ms. Pinelli, when we have a division, do those pieces have to be together and can they stand alone?
Madam Chair, I don't think those pieces need to be together. And as far as standing alone, do you mean if we voted on that, if the committee voted on that, would the rest of the amendment be able to stand alone?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that Mr. McCormick may actually be watching this and may be able to provide assistance to us. I don't know if he's actually on, but I think he may be watching. I was just trying to reach out to him. I agree with Chair Liebling. I don't think in all my time in the legislature I've ever seen in a division that you could vote on two pieces combined, but it does seem like maybe the first question is, could the five different pieces that are being suggested, each one has to be able to stand on their own? But in any case, I guess I have never seen that and really don't think that that's something that can be done. You could have two pieces being voted on at the same time. It has to be that each one of these five pieces can entirely stand on their own. And that may be something Ms. Pinelli can first help us. Could each one of these separate pieces stand on their own? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Ms. Pinelli, would you like us to get advice from Patrick McCormick? Are you comfortable commenting on whether each of the five sections can stand alone?
Madam Chair, I think each of the five sections, apart from those two sections that are related to DWRS, are all amending different parts of the bill and probably could stand each one could stand alone. The two DWRS pieces are related to House File 3100, which is a package of sections that are all related to the disability waiver rate system. If the committee went ahead with only one of those two pieces, then you'd be amending parts of disability waiver rate system, but you wouldn't be including that entire package. So I don't know if that would be able to stand alone or not. I think it probably would, but
they have an effective date that could complicate it, is my understanding. That may not be able to stand alone. Let's see. Hold on a second.
Madam Chair, I think what the issue would be is that you would be making changes to some of the DWRS services and not others, so that the changes wouldn't be consistent throughout.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's my understanding, and again, it's my understanding that each one of these sections has to be able to stand on their own and receive a separate vote on their own. It is not possible to combine two sections. It sounds from Ms. Pinelli, Madam Chair, that in fact these two sections, one on page 2 and one on page 6, cannot be voted on their own. They don't stand on their own. I would assume that's why Lead Albright is wanting to combine them. It's just that that is not something that is possible under our rules. I've never seen that, and I don't know if anybody can point to an example. You can't take a piece from one section and combine it with a piece from another, and then they can stand together. They each have to be able to stand separately, and it doesn't sound like that's the case in this situation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, thank you. We are not creating five different sections. We are carving out two sections, first on page 2 and then again on page 6. Those two sections specifically, and the remainder of the bill would stand on its own. To Representative Pinto's point, I would respectfully disagree with his point that both sections that I am speaking to can stand on their own, and if you would prefer, I can certainly amend my motion to take each one of them separately, but for convenience sake, because they both relate to DWRS and the removal of that language, I've chosen to include both of those in the amendment, but I'm happy to amend to take each one of them separately, but based upon our read and our concurrence with nonpartisan research, both of those sections will stand on their own merits and do not jeopardize the integrity of the remainder of the sections of the bill, of the amendment.
Any other advice from members? Chair Pinto.
So thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just note, this is not a comment on the substance. And if, in fact, each of the sections can stand on their own, then my sort of process objection would go away. And I can't comment on that. Obviously, Ms. Pinelli is the expert on that. And it sounds like Lead Albright is arguing that they could stand separately. And so I'll just say my concern was combining two sections from two different parts of the bill.
I agree. I'm not comfortable combining sections and voting on them, Representative Albright. That could set a very bad precedence in committees. Vice Chair Bonner.
Also, Madam Chair, and maybe we could have House staff mention this, but I believe some of these sections were tied to the competitive workforce factor, and I'm curious how that would interplay with the division. And if that would create an issue with the division.
Representative Albright.
Chair Schultz, I would defer to Ms. Pinelli and other counsel on that if they have understanding of those provisions.
Ms. Pinelli.
Madam Chair, members, the competitive workforce factor is part of this package. I believe all of those exceptions related to the competitive workforce factor are in the language that we're talking about that's on page six. And I don't know if this is helpful at all for the committee, but the reason why the DWRS language is set is sort of separated and is in two separate parts of the amendment is because the sections within the bill, although they're in the same article, they're not all right next to each other, in part because of the recod that was passed. So some of the language is amending statute and some of it is amending session laws.
Vice Chair Bonner.
Thank you. So we don't actually know what effect the division would have on the rate factor.
I think that's correct. So Representative Albright, we have a hard stop at noon. As the chair, because you can vote yes and no up or down on the total amendment, I really prefer not to divide this and combine sections. I don't want to set a precedence for other committees to take sections, put them together and vote on them. This is already a secondary amendment. So I prefer as chair that we vote up or down on the entire package of the A5 amendment. Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, it certainly is within the purview of the chair and your discretion not to divide the amendment. And we would certainly be respectful of your discretion in that venue. That being said, Madam Chair, I would amend my motion to divide out just lines 6.16 through line 6.29 and request a roll call on that as the division of the amendment.
Representative Albright, that's very similar to your first motion. So I'm
Madam Chair, respectfully, I am only placing one section and dividing that out as opposed to, as Ms. Pinelli and others have articulated, the concerns that are possible for the interaction between those two, although I respectfully disagree with it. And so in light of that, I am simplifying my division to only include lines 6.16 through 6.29, which is, I believe, germane to a normative division, as you might have seen in committee before in a number of instances or on the House floor.
Chair Liebling.
Well, Madam Chair, the question always on a division is whether the parts can stand on their own. And I think that what we just heard is that they can't. And it's rather ironic that it's probably because of the recodification. If these two sections were actually together in the bill and you could cleanly cut one off from the other, then it may be a different story. But I think that what we're hearing here is that the division is out of order because you don't have a section that can stand on its own. So I would just ask you to find the division out of order.
Madam Chair, closing comment.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, with all due respect, Chair Liebling, I would disagree. As you've said, as we've heard from nonpartisan staff, their assertion is that both sections that I have called out in the division motion can stand on their own. It is also true that the chair has the discretion to refuse that division. Unfortunately, this comes at a cost to the very people that, in spoken word from the testifiers that we've heard this morning, as well as from both chairs, healthcare is in a crisis and is struggling to provide living wages as well as competitive wages for the people that serve the most vulnerable amongst us. I can see no reason why we would not want to include in this amendment the partitions that would effectively agree with those sentiments and improve their wages by removing them you are basically saying that their wages are less important than others, and I take exception with that. And so that's why I have moved a motion to divide those out to articulate that point specifically. And so with that, Madam Chair, I will leave it up to you to decide at the Chair's discretion how you wish to dispense with my motion.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Let's hear from Representative Keel, then I'm going to rule on this motion to divide. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the discussion. Is it possible to have Ms. Pennelly explain to us whether or not this amendment can stand on its own?
I think we are going to, I'm going to rule this division out of order because they're not joined together, and I don't want to set a bad precedence because these sections are separated in the bill. It doesn't, I mean, and also, honestly, this is, I believe, politically motivated, and I'm going to just restate evidence, facts, for the public. Last year, and previous to that, I worked and my caucus worked to include a competitive workforce factor. We could not call it inflation because the federal government would not allow us to do that. We increased reimbursement rates in the DWS. We invested hundreds of millions of dollars in that. We increased the time that the DWS system reimbursement rates would go up last year. We invested in DWRS. Many of my Republican colleagues voted no on those investments in previous years. Our caucus is committed to increasing reimbursement rates. We want to make sure those reimbursement rates increases go to wages and benefits for those doing the work of caring for our most vulnerable population. So that is a fact that I make that perfectly clear. We are also committed to increasing reimbursement rates for PCAs. Wages that have not gone up, but are tied, when those reimbursement rates goes up, are tied to wages in statute. We are committed to increasing the elderly waiver reimbursement rates so people doing that work can have higher wages. We have limited budgets here. There are significant needs. We are aware of that. It is very tough to have to prioritize. Very difficult. We won't have to if you can convince your colleagues in the Senate to increase the total budget and meet the needs of all Minnesotans by improving these reimbursement rates. And I am committed to making sure that I will advocate, my team will advocate to make sure we get a larger budget out of the GOP Senate. I could use your help with that, representatives. So I'm going to rule that we are not going to divide the amendment. I'm going to rule that out of order, and we are going to proceed to take comments on the overall A5 amendment and then vote on the A5 amendment. So comments related to not the division, but to the A5 amendment are allowed at this time.
Madam Chair.
We have Representative Robbins first, Representative Albright. Representative Robbins. We are not hearing you, Representative Robbins. Well, we have technical difficulties with Representative Rams. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Respectfully, I understand that the Chair's discretion is broad and certainly attempted to accommodate the concerns of different parts within the amendment to accommodate the concerns. But that, with that being said, Madam Chair, with those two partitions still included in it, it's disappointing. Certainly not, as you say, stating motives would probably rise to the concern that I would have in terms of your assertion that this is political. We're just trying to look out for those that have specifically stated that there are needs, and we're trying to address those by our actions within this amendment. That being said, members, this amendment does not address what we've heard yet this morning in countless testimonials from our testifiers. And so with that, I would urge members to vote no on the amendment for adoption.
Thank you, Representative Albright. I just encourage the public to look at our votes and how we vote in the past and in the present and how much we are spending in the House to meet the needs of older adults and people with disabilities. We are making significant investments in wages, in creating a pipeline for caring professionals. So many good things are in this bill. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would request a roll call vote on this amendment.
Thank you. Roll call. We will take a roll call. Let's see, Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if Representative Robbins can get unmuted now. Maybe we should let her go first and
okay,
try again.
Okay, Representative Robbins, can you try again? We're not able to hear you, even when you are unmuted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for the difficulty. And I will respect your request not to belabor this, but I have to say it's incredibly frustrating that you ruled before we heard from Ms. Pinelli about whether this could stand on its own. I feel like we are being silenced and not following procedure, and I just want to put that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. I try to, all year, I have been running a very fair committee, giving everybody voice. I want us to continue to be civil and not be political in this committee because of the area that we address in our jurisdiction. I want to avoid the politics and the theater in this committee. I want to do good work for the people. We all do. And that's what we are trying to do. Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to say, first of all, I think I'm not going to talk about the division decision. I think the chair is correct there, and I think we did hear from Ms. Pugnelli on that point. What I really would like to say, though, too, is that my understanding of what we're doing in the amendment is trying to reconcile with the spreadsheet. And everyone should understand that the bill, it is a large bill. We heard a lot of positive testimony this morning, people who love the investments in the bill. Obviously, it doesn't do enough for everyone, and we all wish that we could do. We are, I just want to say, everyone should understand that a huge bill like this is a work in progress. This is not, the amendment before us is just trying to reconcile the language to the spreadsheet, but this does not mean that we aren't still interested in continuing to try to raise those wages. We all are. And we're going to continue to look for resources and push for resources to be able to do that, because we do hear how important it is. We all want to live in a state where every vulnerable person gets their needs met. I think we all join in that. And as the chair has said, it's really a matter of how we prioritize it. We cannot, you know, so far, we have not been given the resources to meet all the needs that we would like to meet. And I've been in this body for now almost 18 years, and I have never seen a year when we've been able to meet a couple years, when we've been able to meet as many needs as we have. But there's always, always something left undone. So this bill is a work in progress. I don't want anyone to think that we are not interested in meeting every single need that we have heard. We certainly are. And as the bill moves to Ways and Means, we intend to keep trying to work to figure out this really complicated puzzle of how do we meet everybody's needs. That is really our goal. So I really appreciate the chair working on, as I've been mostly busy on the other half of the puzzle. She's done incredible work, and the members of this committee have done amazing work to try to figure this out. But I just want to say to everyone, this is a work in progress. This is not, a commentary on not wanting to meet any of these needs, because we really do hear you. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And I will just add, the expense of the DWRS system, whenever we do a reimbursement rate, we have spending in the current biennium, and then we have to account for spending in the tails, because as a state, we have to balance the budget. DWRS reimbursement rate could cost $150 million in the next biennium and double that or more in the tails. So I urge everyone testifying today, everyone who cares about increasing these reimbursement rates, to beg for a larger budget for HHS in the Senate. We are bringing forward over $700 million in just the biennium in this budget and over $1.2 billion in the tails. We need, as a state, to be responsible for caring for people. That means we need new revenue to meet these needs. I need help. We need help advocating for new revenue to meet the needs of Minnesotans, as you heard from the incredible testimony we hear every day in this committee. That's what we need. We need to prioritize people. We need to prioritize people of Minnesota. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to piggyback on that, when folks are reaching out and saying we need more money to do this, this also means that we're not giving tax cuts to the wealthiest people and to large businesses. These are the kinds of people that we need to invest in. Many of us are authors and co-authors of the DWRS bill. We strongly believe in it, and we're talking about using money to help people in that way as opposed to the wealthiest Minnesotans. And so that message needs to be made loud and clear to the other body as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. And like I always say, when we invest in our people, we all do better. When we invest in people, we all do better. And I hope that we all can make that a priority this session and make these critical investments. Representative Rasmussen, and then we're going to go to a vote after Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to point out to committee members that, you know, we're not in a conference committee yet, and it's my understanding that, you know, that the House and this committee can do what we want to do, including funding DWRS. And it's also my understanding that we don't have a budget target yet. And so this is something that we could do in this committee today. We are not yet in conference with the Senate. So just wanted to make sure that members of this committee were aware and that members of the public were aware. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. I appreciate your comment. We will get a budget resolution. And this is why I'm urging the public to really reach out to make sure we have adequate funding to meet the needs. So we will get that, and we will have to work within the confines of that budget resolution. Okay, with that, members, Ms. Hansen, please call the roll. And I will remind members, we are voting on the A5 amendment to the DE to adopt this amendment. The chair votes aye.
Schultz, aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Reed Albright?
Albright, no.
Albright, no. Representative Bolden?
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle?
Burkle, no.
Burkle, no. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen?
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Thank you. Representative Keel?
Keel, no.
Keel, no. Representative Liebling?
Liebling, aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Mueller?
Mueller, aye.
Mueller, aye. Representative Noor?
Noor, aye.
Noor, aye. Thank you. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Novotny, no. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, no.
Pearson, no. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, no.
Rasmussen, no. Representative Robbins?
No.
Robbins, no. Representative Sandel?
Sandel, aye.
Sandel, aye. And Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Chair Schultz, that's 16, or I'm sorry, 11 ayes and 8 nays. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. Thank you, members. The motion prevails and the A5 amendment is adopted to the DE. Okay, the next amendment we have is the A4 amendment. Representative Keel, would you like to offer your A4 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would.
Okay, Representative Keel moves the A4 amendment. Please explain your amendment, Representative Keel.
Members, thank you, Madam Chair and members. The A4 bill is what we heard this year to help our long-term care providers address the critical staffing shortages with permanent solutions. As a reminder, 15 nursing homes have closed since 2019. And four since January of this year. So 23,000 vacant positions across long-term care with 1 million seniors in the state. So our nursing homes are on the verge of collapse. We actually have one in our district that is hanging on by a thread. I'm not even sure it's that close. But anyway, while critical shortages in staff are occurring statewide, it is especially troubling that our rural communities, where we are in danger of having entire counties without a nursing home if we don't do something now. So I would be shocked if there was anyone on this committee who hasn't heard from some nursing home or provider for this very serious call for help. This amendment, members, would add more wage costs to the facility-specific cost-based portion of the rate and will allow nursing facilities to make needed investments in wages for staff areas like dietary, laundry, housekeeping, and plant operations. It applies to known cost change factor to nursing home rates to mitigate the effects of the 21-month delay under our current payment system. This will allow nursing homes to payment to be more accurately reflective in the current level of cost for things like staffing, food, and utilities, which I'm guessing are rapidly going up. So, and then it for fully converts the 2017 rate system for elderly waiver program, which provides the variety of services to clients in community settings. By DHS own analysis, less than 20% of the rates that are based in the new system. And with that reminder, the frozen rate is far short of the wages and benefits needed to provide the services. It provides upfront funding, which is the sole purpose of the increasing nursing home caregiver wages. So I thank members for the support and hope you would consider supporting this amendment to our bill.
Thank you, Representative Keel. I believe we were all serving on this committee because we care about older adults and our most vulnerable and people with disabilities. And we definitely are committed to helping our long-term care facilities. I just want to remind members of the resources we've provided as a from the executive branch, the governor, and how we spend the federal dollars, and as legislators, the DFL legislators and others. So in March of 2020 through September 2021, DHS authorized Section 12A Medicaid emergency funding for nursing facilities. They received requests of $13.2 million from 60 different nursing facilities, so we spent $13.2 million on that piece. DHS forgave skilled nursing facilities federal funds based on some CMS feedback, and those offsets cost $45 million of a state budget impact. In December 2021, DHS authorized $50 million in ARPA funding as emergency grants to all nursing facilities for retention and hiring bonuses. 90% were paid to on-site workers. In January 2022, Medicaid rates interim rates increased, and this was reflected in the budget forecast. It was equivalent to about $52 million in higher spending. And in January to May of this year, DHS authorized application-based Section 12A Medicaid emergency funds to assist individual facilities with staffing or cash flow emergencies. This was estimated to be $31 million, yet I believe no nursing facilities have yet requested this emergency funding. So we estimate that Minnesota's nursing facilities may have received in excess of $171 million in federal COVID funding assistance since April 2020. That's $133 million from the Provider Relief Fund and $38 million in COVID quality incentives. Additionally, Minnesota's nursing facilities have received something in the range of $41 million in Small Business Administration loans. with the potential for at least an additional $112 million in forgivable loans. And federal HRSA authorized a phase four round of provider relief funds, so we expect more funding to come and be available to our nursing facilities. And members, in our current omnibus bill, we have additional funding for long-term care facilities. We have recommended $5.5 million in 2023 and $8.2 million in 2024 as a temporary grant program that would support MDH-licensed long-term care facilities for improvements to their physical environment and technology and other things to prepare for reducing the risk of future transmissions of COVID-19. We have funding that's of over $12.5 million over 2 years for this program. And we have workforce incentive funding to provide retention incentive bonus payments, loan or tuition reimbursement, payments for childcare costs and transportation costs in this package. We have money for respite care. We increased homemaker rates.
Peter and John, stop.
Oops, Lindsay, you need to mute. Sorry about that. We have money in for our PACE program, which is Representative Albright's bill to avoid nursing facilities, keep people in their homes as long as possible, and live independently as much as possible as well. And finally, we have evidence from reports on the value-based reimbursement system in nursing homes that was passed in 2015, I believe. And we have recent reports that are on our committee website, and I believe were circulated via email on the change of ownership in nursing facilities that we have great concerns with, which I will refer to those reports. And I'm just going to quote a few of the evidence we have looking at whether the value-based reimbursement systems in our nursing facilities has been effective in improving quality, which was the intent. So VBR is a way we pay nursing facilities for their costs, and the intent of that legislation was to improve quality of care to the residents and their quality of life and their health outcomes. And this is what the reports that were conducted by Purdue and the University of Minnesota discovered about our VBR system. And I believe we get these reports every year or every few years on evaluating VBR. But what they found was that, the evaluation found no evidence that VBR's quality incentives led to higher facility quality. A stronger threshold is needed for the VBR reimbursement system that would have more impact on facilities. In terms of the change of ownership, we've seen a lot of private equity for-profit firms coming in buying our nursing facilities when VBR was implemented. This is a big concern because change of and ownership of facilities has increased during this VBR period, and facilities that experienced a change in ownership since 2014 are characterized by generally lower quality metrics than their peers. And finally, administrative management fees saw an unusually, this is a quote from the report, large jump, double the usual percentage increase in 2018, while the cluster facilities with lower quality measures had the highest central office and general administrative other costs per resident day. There's a separate report on just the change of ownership facilities, and that report found that the CHOW facilities, change of ownership or CHOW, performed worse than facilities with consistent ownership on every quality-related metric. Quality scores and subcomponents, for instance, quality measures on staffing, retention, community discharge, and hospitalizations. There was a discernible downward trend in quality for facilities after the change of ownership event. Moreover, the gap in quality scores between CHOW and non-CHOW facilities widened after that CHOW event. CHOW facilities reduced spending on laundry and dental benefits while increasing spending more slowly than other facilities on medical and scholarship benefits. They increased administrative management fees at a higher rate than other facilities. So I encourage members to please read through those reports, and it's our responsibility to address payments to nursing facilities, because I know we all have the goal and the intent that we want to provide the highest level of quality in our long-term care settings. And there is concern across the state that these private equity firms may be damaging the quality of care that's being provided. And this is not just in Minnesota. This is across the country. We have very good research that shows that this is a concern in our state, and it's our responsibility to address that. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have some, just in the conversation of funding, when we look at all the funding that nursing homes are getting, I think we need to really reflect on the fact that they're still suffering. There's still a problem. When you refer to private industry owning nursing homes, I don't have a lot of that in my district, and the one that is failing now is owned by the city. And the only reason the city purchased it was because they had to have something when the Good Samaritan system moved out of the area. And in lack of staff, I want to relate a story. I wasn't going to say anything about this, but I went to church on Sunday, saw a couple of my young ladies home from college, and I said, how's it going? I knew both of them were into nursing. And they said, well, okay, but I have quit the nursing program. And I am hearing from parents the same thing. Why? Because the mandate is that they have to be vaccinated. They have chosen not to be vaccinated, so they're walking away. I have nurses walking away. And that's true all over the state of Minnesota. So part of our problem is that we are not even encouraging people to go into this facility or this field because of their concerns about vaccines. Now, I don't want that to be a conversation. That's someone's personal decision. But the other thing is family have a hard time putting people in nursing homes because they do not want to be isolated from their families. And so I even have taken my own father to a doctor's appointment, and he begged me not to leave him there. They would not allow me to walk in with him, even though they kept asking me if I was a visitor, and said, no, I'm his advocate. And we took him out, and they weren't even addressing what he needed. But the concern among seniors is that they will not have their family around. And I believe that that's part of our numbers for why the nursing homes do not have the numbers they need or can use, and people need that service. We have certainly letting seniors stay in their homes as long as possible is important. But the other thing that is really important to understand is it's not always possible to take care of family members in a home setting. Their houses are older, there's steps, there's all kinds of issues, and or their physical needs that have to be happened. And that's the other concern. Our nursing homes are having to use much higher care of services because that's who they have. It isn't the multitude of different types of services they're delivering to each person that is there. So we're having higher needs, and it's really important. And then, Madam Chair, I would really ask that we do a roll call on this vote, on this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Roll call has been requested on the amendment vote. Thank you, Representative Keel. I know that most of our nursing homes are providing excellent care in the state, and they're still struggling. This is true. But we want to make sure that that money going to, for instance, the private equity-controlled nursing facilities, we want to make sure that those investments are being used to care and providing the highest quality of care to those residents. And my concern, and it's shared among others, is that that money is leaving the nursing facility, not going towards higher wages or to improve quality for those private equity controlled nursing facilities, for some of them. I mean, we have some bad actors, and we want to make sure that the money, the state dollars we do spend, is used for the residents, for the wages, to provide the best level of care and quality that we can get. I think we all agree on that. So we just have to, our job is to make sure that that it can happen, that that is happening. And so I hope that members can work on this issue and use the evidence we have, the scientific evidence of this research, the investigations, the reporting to improve our VBR system. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of closing comments. you know, one of the things that I've observed in the comments about this amendment, one is we are doing a broad cross-section in a number of initiatives to provide for our nursing homes. But, Madam Chair, that being said, it's clearly not enough if you're not able to retain qualified staff while we are also witnessing the closing of facilities or, sadly, the denial of those same residents from accepting new residents. So something is going on here. And on a professional note, Madam Chair, I've heard it said in a couple of comments on this amendment and the one previous, please don't vilify private equity. That is the marketplace trying to insert real capital into real instances where it is really needful to support and to sustain those very establishments that would be going out of business if private equity firms would not insert their own capital at their own risk, particularly in light of what we just got done talking about with low reimbursement rates and with a shortage of staff. So please, the private equity firms that you speak of are not the villains here. This is a systemic issue. And I will leave you with this. We have more people age 65 and older now than we have in the K-12 system. And it is only going to be exacerbated in the years to come. So clearly, we are not funding these substantially enough to take care of the very people that we say that we're wanting to take care of. And so I would urge members to support the Keel Amendment and improve the product that we are going to move out of this committee today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. And I really do hear the passion in your voice, which makes me optimistic that we can all work together on this. You know, as an economist, I understand the value of private equity. I also understand that there's a profit motive, that they need to earn a rate of return. And I think we can all acknowledge that that is true. And, you know, that not all private equity firms have that goal. They may want to have a mission of making sure we have nursing facilities open and operating across the state. But I think we also have to be realistic about what some of those goals are and just monitor what is happening in our nursing facilities. But with that, members, we are running out of time. So I'm going to go to Representative Keel for closing comments on her amendment, and then we'll do the roll call vote. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I urge you all to reconsider and support this amendment. I think it is vitally important, as I've expressed earlier. Chair Schultz, you mentioned that we want this to go to the workers. This is absolutely what this bill does. It goes to the workers. It confirms that people, whether you're washing dishes, cleaning floors, providing food, all of those services are very important. And someone cleaning a room is important to that resident. They see things, they talk to them, they have relationships with them also. I see them at funerals because they've had a relationship with a resident. So this is really, really important that we help all of those people that work within that system of care and would encourage a yes vote. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Keel. This is not a vote against workers. This is a no vote on an amendment that makes changes to a bill. And I am committed to making sure that all of our caring professionals are getting a living wage, that they're getting adequate benefits. And our caucus has brought forward many, many bills to do that across the industries. I'll just remind members that the VBR system is set up so that the nursing facilities are reimbursed their costs so they can increase wages and they will get reimbursed their costs. So with that, members, I urge a no vote on this amendment, and I hope we can all work together on and support our other bills as well to increase wages for our frontline workers. So, Ms. Hansen, please prepare to take the roll. The chair votes no.
Schultz, no. Vice Chair Bonner?
Fortunately, no.
Bonner, no. Lead Albright?
Albright, aye.
Albright, aye. Representative Bolden?
Bolden, no.
Bolden, no. Representative Burkle?
Burkle, aye.
Burkle, aye. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, no.
Fisher, no. Representative Frederick?
No.
Frederick, no. Representative Hansen?
Hansen, no.
Hansen, no. Representative Keel?
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Thank you. Representative Liebling?
Liebling, no.
Liebling, no. Representative Moeller?
Moeller, no.
Moeller, no. Representative Knorr?
Knorr, no.
Knorr, no. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Novotny, aye. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Representative Pinto?
No.
Pinto, no. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Robbins, aye. Representative Sandell?
Sandell, no.
Sandell, no. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Thank you, members, and sorry about before my children are home today. Chair Schultz, that's 11, no. I'm sorry, 8 ayes and 11 nays.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. Do not apologize for children making noises in the background. That's fine. So, members, the motion does not prevail, and the amendment is not adopted. We have one more amendment to the DE, and that is Amendment A6. Representative Rasmussen, would you like to move the A6 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would move the A6 amendment.
Okay, Representative Rasmussen moves the A6 amendment. Please describe your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The A6 amendment would attach House File 2818, which we heard in this committee earlier this session, and I appreciate Chair Schultz giving this bill a hearing. This provision would allow Pioneer Care Nursing Home in Fergus Falls to access the new property payment system, which more fairly compensates nursing homes that have made large property investments that improve the experience for staff and residents. For members who may not remember, the new property payment system was put in place in 2019. From that time on, any new projects approved through a moratorium exception get the new property rate system. And without this bill, Pioneer Care would need to seek a new project through the moratorium exception to get access to the new property rate system. Because Pioneer's nursing home was built brand new in 2010, there isn't necessarily a need to make any additional capital investments at this time. And looking at the lifespan of their facility, they're basically in a brand new building. So the moratorium exception process is not an appropriate answer for Pioneer Care's unique situation. And for those reasons, Madam Chair, members, through this amendment and the bill, we're seeking a limited legislative solution, and so would ask for and appreciate members' support of the A6 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. I really appreciate that you're championing a facility in your district. I just have a question, Representative Rasmussen. Did this bill move in the Senate, and is it in Senator Abler's omnibus bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the question. I would have to go and look at the latest version of the bill to see, but I know that Senator Engelbretson is championing it in the Senate.
And has it had a committee hearing in the Senate, Representative Rasmussen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would have to follow up with the Senate author.
Okay, thank you. Please do so and let me know. But for at this time, members, I'm going to be voting down this amendment, and we will work with the Senate and Representative Rasmussen in the future to talk about the property value issue. And I know DHS is also working on this issue, and it affects probably more than just Representative Rasmussen's facility. So I prefer to do a global solution that hopefully we can work on in conference committee. So I urge members to vote no on this amendment. I don't believe there was a roll call vote, so we will do a voice vote. All those in favor of the A6 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed, please say no.
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 The motion does not prevail and the A6 amendment is not adopted. Okay, members. The next, so that is that we are finished with amendments to the DE. My motion, I'm going to next move to amend the vehicle, House File 4579, with the DE A22-0415 as amended. This is a voice vote. All those in favor? Representative Albright, sorry. Representative Albright.
I would move a roll call on the adoption of the DE.
Thank you. Roll call having been requested, we'll do a roll call. Ms. Hansen, please prepare a roll call vote.
Certainly. Chair Schultz?
The chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Lead Albright?
Albright votes no.
Albright no. Representative Bolden?
Bolden aye.
Bolden aye. Representative Burkle?
Burkle no.
Burkle no. Representative Fisher?
Fisher aye.
Fisher aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Aye. Frederick aye. Representative Hansen?
Hansen aye.
Hansen aye. Representative Keel?
Keel no.
Keel no. Representative Liebling?
Liebling aye.
Liebling aye. Representative Mueller?
Mueller aye.
Mueller aye. Representative Noor?
Noor aye.
Noor aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny no.
Novotny no. Representative Pearson?
Pearson no.
Pearson no. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen no.
Rasmussen no. Representative Robbins?
No.
Robbins no. Representative Sandell?
Aye.
Sandell aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher no.
Schumacher no. Thank you, sir. Chair Schultz, that's 11 ayes and 8 nays.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. The motion prevails and the DE amendment as the DE as amended is adopted on House File 4579. So the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Okay, members. Finally, I'm going to make the motion. So I move to re-refer House File 4579 as amended and recommend it to be re-referred to Ways and Means. And I will add that the nonpartisan staff is directed to make any technical changes or corrections as needed. This will be a roll call and the chair votes aye.
Schultz aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner aye. Lead Albright?
Albright no.
Albright no. Representative Bolden?
Bolden aye.
Bolden aye. Representative Burkle?
Burkle no.
Burkle no. Representative Fisher?
Fisher aye.
Fisher aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick aye. Representative Hansen?
Hansen aye.
Hansen aye. Representative Keel?
Keel no.
Keel no. Thank you. Representative Liebling?
Liebling aye.
Liebling aye. Representative Mueller?
Mueller aye.
Mueller aye. Representative Noor?
Noor aye.
Noor aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny no.
Novotny no. Representative Pearson?
Pearson no.
Pearson no. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, no.
Rasmussen, no. Representative Robbins?
No.
Robbins, no. Representative Sandell?
Sandell, yes. Aye.
Thank you, sir. Sandell, yes. And Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Chair Schultz, that's 11 ayes and 8 nays.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. The motion prevails in House File 4579 as amended and recommended to Ways and Means and the direction to nonpartisan staff to make any technical changes or corrections as needed. The motion prevails. House File 4579 as amended and recommended is on its way to Ways and Means. Members, this could potentially be our last committee hearing of the session. I want to thank everyone for all the hard work they're doing. I also want to thank everyone for getting through this year in a short year, short session. We've done amazing work on working and to spend the surplus on needed investments in human services and also doing the work for the people that may not have a loud voice at the Capitol, but have needs that need to be met. I want to thank everyone for working together and in a civil way this year. I also want to remind the public and our advocates and lobbyists to, if you have concerns about this bill or comments or suggestions, to please send those to me via email. Our staff do need a few days of rest, so I encourage you to just talk directly with me about concerns and maybe provide some rest for our staff who have worked very long hours in crafting these bills and making sure we're doing the best work we can here at the Capitol. Vice Chair Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the indulgence. And I just wanted to say briefly, the chair covered so much of this, but I really want to thank Chair Schultz for her excellent leadership, and we will certainly miss her as she moves on to her next steps. And to the staff and of course, even the members here today, I think during testimony, it's very clear that the issues we address in this committee can be heart-wrenching and difficult and fraught with challenges and nuance and complexity. And I appreciate that all of our members bring such sensitivity to the issue. So thank you for all of your hard work, and thank you to Chair Schultz for your leadership as well.
Thank you, Chair. Vice Chair Bonner, we appreciate your help as well this session. As I was called away to do other things, thank you for taking the gavel, and look forward to see what you will be doing next year in committee. Lead Albright.
Chair Schultz, first and foremost, I wanted to thank you for presiding over this committee over the last several months. You have been diligent. You have persevered through some difficult times, both technological and otherwise. So I would just personally tip my hat to you and thank you for providing that leadership. It probably goes without saying that both sides of the aisle come at these issues from different perspectives. But I hope that our genuineness in terms of providing that observation and those comments serve a greater purpose in terms of providing a better outcome for the committee and the work product that we produce and bring forward to the larger body on the floor of the House. So again, as has been said before, my personal thanks to both nonpartisan and partisan staff, and to all those who have advocated for their constituents on behalf of the bills and the initiatives in this final omnibus bill. We wish them the best, and we wish rest for those that need it the most as we move forward through the rest of the session. So with that, thank you, Madam Chair, and best of luck to you in your endeavors.
I want to thank you, Representative Albright. It's been a pleasure serving with you, and I have so much gratitude to you for being a lead on this committee and for all the work you've done over time. And I'm excited about the provisions that you have included in this bill, the PACE provisions, and I hope that will be successful as well as we roll that out in future years. You know, in my 8 years here at the legislature, I've been in divided government, and we have been able to do incredible work. And so, you know, I wish the federal level, they could take lessons from the Minnesota legislature and how we work across the aisle and really with all parties, because it's not just Republicans and Democrats. We have new Republicans, we have independents, and we really do work together. And I think going forward, we need to make a greater effort to unify our state and our country and show the country how we can work, even though we have different opinions and we have some different ideology. But ultimately, I hope that we all share the same values. And in this committee, it is valuing people and is investing in people. And it is making sure that they have the opportunities and the resources they need to lead very full, high quality lives. And so I want to thank everybody. And I know that we have a legislative break coming up, and I'm not sure. I know I have another committee hearing, others may as well, but we will continue to do this important work. And I'm looking forward to working with my counterpart, Representative Abler, former representative, And working with Chair Liebling and the HHS team in the House and our counterparts in the Senate to produce another historic Health and Human Services package for the people across our state. And with that, members, we are adjourned, and I hope to see everybody on the floor at 12. Bye-bye.